Bhushtoyam Agnir Pravanam Kam Adir.
Bhushtoyam Agnir Pravanam Adir.
Mahan Adyadir Mana Indriyani.
Mahan Adyadir Mana Indriyani.
Savindriyarta Vividas Chasave.
Savindriyarta Vividas
Yahitavaste jagato nirga bhuta.
Yahitavaste jagato nirga bhuta.
Bhu.
Bhu.
Earth.
Earth.
Toyam.
Toyam.
Water.
Water.
Agnir.
Agnir.
Fire.
Fire.
Pavanam.
Pavanam.
Air.
Air.
Kam.
Kam.
Ita.
Ita.
Adi.
Adi.
And its source, false
and ego.
Mahan,
Mahan,
the Mahatattva.
Aja,
the total material nature.
Adi,
her source,
the Supreme Lord.
Mana,
the mind.
Indriyani,
the
senses.
Sarva Indriya,
of all the senses. Artha,
Artha,
the objects.
Vibhuta,
the demigods. Cha,
and
Sarve,
all.
Ye,
which.
Hitava,
causes.
Te,
your.
Jagata, of the universe.
Anga,
from the body.
Bhuta,
generated.
Generated.
Translation by the disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, and its source, false ego, the Mahatattva, the total material nature, and her source, the Supreme Lord, Purusha, expansion, the mind, the senses, the sense objects, and the senses presiding deities, all these causes of the cosmic manifestation are born from your transcendental body. Text 3. Naiti svarupam vidur atmanaste hyajodayo natmataya grihata ajo nubada sagune ajaya gunat param veda nate svarupam. The total material nature and these other elements of creation certainly cannot know you as you are, for they are manifested in the realm of dull matter. Since you are beyond the modes of nature, even Lord Brahma, who is bound up in these modes, does not know your true identity. Purport. God is transcendental to material nature. Unless we also transcend the limited consciousness of material existence, we cannot know Him. Even the greatest living entity in the universe, Brahma, cannot understand the Supreme unless He comes to the platform of pure Krishna consciousness. Om Jnana Tmanandasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmanitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpat Rubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivastani Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So here we are in the prayers of Asura. He's just seen the wonderful sight manifested in the river Jamuna of Krishna in a four-armed fawn lying on his Anantashesha bed, surrounded by all the devas glorifying him. And now he's offering his prayers to the Lord. His prayers begin by acknowledging that the Lord Narayan is the cause of all causes. He is the cause of Lord Brahma, who then caused this cosmic manifestation. And now these verses we're looking at today, they enumerate the various elements of existence, material existence. And Akuru is pointing out that these elements come from the Lord's body. The idea is that everything is in fact the Lord. Everything is in fact Krishna. And because we and the living entities, which includes the devas and so forth, are small parts of the Supreme, we are not actually able to comprehend the scope of the existence of the Lord. It is actually beyond the scope of the small sky of our consciousness to contain the unlimited expanse of the Lord's existence. So Akura goes on in these prayers to speak of different modes of worship. These days, you know, people say there's so many spiritual paths. And it's true. If we look at the Vedas, they are very broad literatures. They give very broad range of options, actually, for things you could do. Both in the mundane and the super mundane and the spiritual spheres. They teach how we can live in this world in a way that is harmonious with the dharma of things, the nature of things. They teach how we might be able, how we can ascend to higher realms of being, where we can enjoy cosmic sense gratification with other cosmic beings. They teach about transcendence, liberation, and the various destinations in the spiritual world. It's a very broad-minded body of literature, the Vedic corpus. Akrura, he points out that some worship the Lord as the complete whole, the universe, and that's very popular these days. People like the idea that God is the universe. And we should worship that. We should appreciate nature. We should appreciate all things natural. The Vedas understand nature a bit more deeply than the common person these days. They say that actually nature, the physical nature, is a aspect that rests upon the personalities behind nature, because the Vedic understanding of things is that consciousness is the foundation of all being. Just like our body rests upon our consciousness. And the body has, or the bodily elements have assembled around the spirit soul. When the spirit soul leaves the body, the body will disintegrate. The elements will go their separate ways. Currently they're all joined together in this body. But when the spirit soul leaves, the body will disintegrate. And the consciousness or will is the foundation of all action. It's not the other way around, that there's some something happens in your brain, chemistry, and then you get a thought. Then your emotions follow that. It's true that the emotions and body are connected, but depending on how we, first we will, according to our ego or sense of self, we desire certain things. The mind throws up these desires. That could come from the outside, the senses, bring in some stimulus and we think, oh, that's nice. So, or it can come from inside. But in any case, we develop some desire within the mind, and we become attached to that. And the intelligence then plans, how shall I get it? And then, having planned, the senses are then put into action. So consciousness is actually the foundation of all being. It's the same in the universe. The elements of the cosmic manifestation rest upon the consciousness of the devas. They control things. The mechanics, physical mechanics of things, that is secondary to the consciousness behind all these things. It's the idea behind, these days there's a very popular theory called Gaia theory. Gaia was a demigoddess in Greek mythology, the goddess of nature, Gaia. So these days scientists and intellectuals, they are looking at nature as a whole and seeing that actually nature as a whole is like an organism unto herself. Therefore they give this organism called Gaia. She is self-regulating, and depending on how we relate to Gaia, she responds. So this is not very alien to the followers of the Vedas. We understand that Gaia can also be known as Bhumi, Mother Earth. And there are many devas, as we saw in our Indra Puja festival. I saw Govardhan Puja festival, the play, which was named Indra Puja, because Indra was initially the focus of that event until he got deflated by Krishna's drama. There were many devas there. Many people came and we gave them personalities. We said, you are Jyoti, the presiding deity of light. You are Chandra, god of the moon, various demigods. And this is the Vedic understanding of things. So Akrura, he says that some people, they worship demigods as parts of the body of the Lord, limbs of the body. And they say other people, they worship jnana, knowledge, transcendental knowledge. They use their mind to try and penetrate into the ultimate nature of things. Through philosophical analysis, they hope to separate reality from illusion and in this way liberate the consciousness from the network of Maya. And then Pancharatra, he talks about that a certain group, the Bhagavatars, they engage in Pancharatra. They get properly initiated, they decorate the body with tilak, they enter the temple and they worship Vishnu form. Vishnu forms, of which there are many. And then there's the Shivites, and they worship Shiva as a representative of Supreme Lord. So in this way we see the Vedic, and this is just a few, the Vedic process is abroad. There are many different paths, many goals. But you see, the acharyas, see this broadness, this so many options can be confusing. Well, what to actually do, you know? It's very difficult, you know. Sometimes we're worshipping a Lord, Krishna. Krishna is the universe. He is within every atom. He is the demigods. He is us, even. We are expansions of him, small expansions, individual units, but we're born out of his energy. Whose energy are we born out of? Must be Krishna's, because Krishna is everything. We worship Krishna, who appears in so many different forms. There are so many Vishnumurtis. He comes as a fish, a tortoise, a boar, Kapila Muni, Rama, so many different incarnations. of Krishna, Lord Chaitanya. And in this way we can kind of, how to contain this conception of the Absolute within the mind. Very difficult. For example, Arjuna, he wanted to see the universal form on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And Krishna said, no, you can't actually not see this form with your present eyes. You have limited senses. This is one thing that scientists don't realize these days, when trying to comprehend the totality of things, that the senses are limited. And therefore, they're somewhere in between the breakdown, in between the external world and the consciousness, there is a lot of data being lost, and there is a lot of interpretation coming in from the subconscious mind. So therefore, you can never actually know for sure what is this reality, what is outside of us, what are we actually experiencing, because it's all subjective. And we're perceiving through an imperfect medium. Anyway, Krishna said, your senses are limited, you cannot perceive this universal form, but I will give you the means by which you can do it. I will give you the consciousness of the universal form. And then Krishna did that. He gave Arjuna divine eyes by which he could perceive the complete expanse of the Bharat Rupa, Krishna's universal form. And Arjuna freaked out, actually. He could not contain it. It was just too vast. He said, I'm offering obeisances to you hundreds and hundreds of times from all sides, because you are on all sides. He could see everything, including himself. He could see past, present and future. He could see the soldiers on the battlefield of Kurukshetra entering into the mouths of the Bharat Rupa and getting their heads smashed between his teeth. He got overwhelmed by this incredible manifestation of Krishna. And he became a little bit fearful, actually. And then Krishna saw this. Arjuna mentioned it, and Krishna also saw it, and he said, okay, enough. And then again, covered Arjuna. So he just was on the chariot, and there was Krishna. First he showed him his forehand form, and then he resumed his two-hand form. And Arjuna said, this form is so beautiful. And Krishna said, yes, this form is very beautiful. In fact, this form is the highest form. This is the original form. And only by eyes tinged with the salve of love, or bhakti, can one actually perceive this form. So the Acharyas analyzed that of all the Vishnu forms, the form of Krishna is the original Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam, and also the most attractive, the most complete in manifestation. What is that manifestation? That is the capacity for relationship or intimate exchange. All of Vishnu forms, they have 60 qualities. Actually unlimited qualities, but Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami, he enumerates 60 qualities. But then, above and beyond Narayan forms, are four extra qualities that Krishna possesses. Those charms the entire universe. Intimate pastimes with devotees, charming beauty beyond compare, and there's one other. Always surrounded by devotees? Yeah. Lila. So this is the nature of Krishna. He is super attractive, super sweet. You know, the Christians and so forth, they have a concept of God that one should fear God. And if you read the Bible, if you've got time, it's quite a big book, and it's a lot. There's a lot of ranting in the Bible, actually. you meet this God who is very heavy duty. He says to Moses, this is the way it shall be. You know, he says pretty heavy things actually. And these are the sacrifices, animal sacrifices I want. If you do not obey them, these will be the consequences. I will send a plague among you. It's quite a megalomaniacal God. Big controller. And the followers, the Israelites, of this aspect of God are very fearful. But they're also unable to control their senses, so they're always falling down from the path of the law of Moses that Moses received. And this has got some interesting laws, like one should not sleep with one's mother's sister, and one should not, or one's mother's daughter, and one should not cook a young goat in its mother's own milk. All sorts of interesting laws that you're supposed to do. And if one has a skin defect, one must leave the city for 7 days. And then you come back and be examined by the priest, and if it's still not cleared up, you send them out again. All sorts of interesting laws that are supposed to be followed to the letter. And the temple of worship should be such and such dimensions. And you know, anyway, I won't get too much into the Bible. It's an interesting book. But the Israelites always fall down. And he says, I am a vengeful God, a jealous God. In fact, I want you to go into the land and I want you to destroy these people's cities. I'm giving the land unto you. You go in there. They have displeased me. They have worshipped other gods other than myself. They have worshipped gods that their hands have made. They have displeased me. Therefore, go in and raise the city to the ground. Do not leave a single stone standing. Kill all the men. Kill all the boys. Kill all the women, even if they're pregnant, including the animals. They have displeased me. And it says that fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So this is one manifestation of the, one conception of the Godhead. This very authoritarian autocrat is sitting on the top of existence dictating, this is how it shall be, and if one does not follow my will, then there shall be consequences. And there's nothing you can do about it because I'm all powerful. So it's interesting. And even in the Vedas they say that the wind is blowing out of fear of the Lord. The sun is shining out of the fear of the Lord. And in fact, there is reactions to actions. There is suffering for certain acts. This is all the law of God. If you act in a certain way, you get a certain result. This is all delineated in the Vedas. And they say this is how you should behave yourself. If you do not, then there shall be certain reactions. That's called dharma. Therefore, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. If you fear the Lord, then you will follow His instructions and you will live very happily. So this is one conception of the Godhead. But there are higher conceptions. And if you read the Krishna book introduction, Prabhupada explains that one thing that all the religions of the world have missed is that God is actually the supreme enjoyer. This is the actual highest manifestation of the Godhead. In terms of cosmic administration, He can do that through other agencies of His supreme potencies. But He personally, He is enjoying rasa in the spiritual world. He is the supreme enjoyer. Therefore, the acharyas have analyzed that Krishna, actually, of all the enjoyers, He is the best. He is the best enjoyer. He is the sweetest, and He has more intimate pastimes than any other form of the Godhead. Therefore, Krishna Bhakti, or devotion to Krishna, is actually the highest expression of consciousness, and is also the highest experience of consciousness. And Krishna Bhakti, you don't have to wait until you go to the spiritual world to taste Krishna Bhakti. Krishna Bhakti is simply a state of consciousness. And we are trying to cultivate that in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, the point I want to make today is that if in doubt, or if not in doubt, one should tune into devotion or devotional service to Krishna. We're practicing to do that, to attain this loving sentiment, this consciousness of Krishna. And there's so many things we could think about. There's so many conceptions we could have of the Absolute. Most people don't even have a conception of the Absolute. They're just involved in sense gratification according to how the modes are dictating. And in this way the mind fills up. There's so many things we could think about every day. We could think about, you know, wake up in the morning, how do I feel? Do I feel comfortable or do I feel in a bit of anxiety? Or we could think of that. Or we could be sitting there and thinking, that other person's really got a lot of faults. Yeah. Or we could think about the future. What is possible? Maybe one day I'll have a house. That'll be nice. Maybe one day I'll go to some place, you know? Maybe one day I'll achieve this certain thing. Or maybe it'll be... Or maybe worry, anxiety. Oh, what if this happens? What if that happens? Most worry is actually irrational. Worry is just simply a mechanism of going over things that could possibly go wrong so you can make a plan how to defend yourself should the need arise. But many people these days, they have so little control over the mind that this worry just becomes chronic. It's called anxiety disorder. It's very common, actually. The mind loops, you know. Oh my God, you know, I'm driving the car. Oh, what's that sound? You know, oh, that, oh, what if the car breaks down? Hang on, but I need to get to work. I might be late. Oh, it might cost lots of money to fix. What if it costs like $2,000 to fix? But I'm trying to save money for my son to go to university. Oh my God, I hope he passes his exams, you know. And this way you loop over one worry to the other, and then you're back, oh, the car sounds, oh, what's that sound? And this loop goes in the mind. You can't break out of it, and you get what's called anxiety or disorder. Where nothing's actually going wrong, but within the mind, you're imagining so many possible problems that could arise. This is called worrying, and when it becomes chronic, it turns into anxiety disorder. It's very common these days. It can turn into depression as well. In any case, yeah, that can be going on in the mind. We can also have fantasies in the mind. In fact, 99.999% of what goes on in the mind is a fantasy. It's completely imagined. We have fantasies about other people, what they're really like, what they're thinking of us, what we can get out of them. And when we have more overt manifestations of fantasy, we deliberately go and think up something incredible, you know, like we want to make a movie or something, so we think up some far out fantastical story to manifest. Or we might be sitting there thinking, what am I missing out on? You know, I'm here in the temple, and I could be having sense gratification, I could be doing this, could be doing that. Or we could tune into our doubts. Or we can tune into, you know, our desires, our attractions to things or to other people and get absorbed in that and a fantasy born out of that. Or we can tune into our things to do. We've got so many things to do and therefore I've got to manage all these things. And many of these things are necessary. At different times of the day we have to tune into different realities, to tune the mind into different things in order to organize our life. But essentially a devotee means that at the end of the day, at the beginning of the day, and when there's nothing else really pressing, we should tune into devotion. We should tune into devotional service. We should check our existential motivation. Are we trying to be devotees? Are we thinking of ourselves as servants? Are we tuned into the beauty of Krishna? So the opulence of Krishna. This is the practice of the devotee. This is the lifestyle of a devotee. And we are devotees of Krishna, so therefore we tune into Krishna Bhakti. We might be cultivating, that's a practice as well. In fact, a lot of our regulated duties in Krishna consciousness are simply to train the mind how to think of Krishna. Many of them are to entertain in a regulated way so we can, our desires and our propensities, so we can gradually get over them. And the grip that we have on these, they'll release, relax a little, and then we won't be so attached. Then we still act in that way because we act according to our nature, that is Krishna conscious philosophy, but we're tuned into devotion. We're simply doing it to please Krishna. See, the mind is like or the consciousness is like a radio receptor. And as one Buddhist monk once said in his poem, he said, mind has more projections than the dust nodes of the sun. In other words, the mind can think of unlimited things. It can take you to unlimited worlds and states of being. Where is that yogi who can see things as they are? And the point is, even in the spiritual world, things are subjective. If we were to see things as they are, like everything, we'd be like Arjuna, totally perplexed and overwhelmed by the scope of Krishna's being. So even in the spiritual world, like Mother Yashoda, Balaram, and the other cowherd boys, they came to Mother Yashoda and they said, Krishna's been eating dirt. He's a naughty boy. He's been eating dirt. So Mother Yashoda said, oh, is this true? Krishna, come here. And Krishna said, actually, they've just conspired against me because I'm beating them in their game, or I won't play with them, or something like that. They're upset when, you know, kids get into fights, so then they're actually conspiring against me. I have not been eating dirt. It's not a fact. They're lying. And he said, and if you doubt, just look into my mouth and see. If there's dirt in there, then you will know I'm a liar. So Mother Yashoda said, okay, I will do that. And she opened Krishna's mouth and looked in. What did she see? She saw something similar to what Arjuna saw. The entire scope of existence within Krishna. And she became bewildered as well, because who can see this? Our small consciousness, how can we contain such a vision from all sides? And she even saw herself inside looking into Krishna's mouth, and in Krishna's mouth there was the entire scope of existence. Within that scope of existence there was Krishna with his mouth open, Mother Yashoda looking in, and then this existence again. You know, have you ever seen like these mirror rooms where you can look into the mirror and it bounces back and it just looks like a tunnel going on forever? She saw that, as well as everything else. And she said, oh, golly, what is going on? Am I sick? No, I'm in good health. Are the demigods playing some trick on me? Why would they do that? I'm just a simple woman. Am I going mad? No, I'm okay. It must be Vishnu's illusory energy. And then she began to pray. Similar, actually, our Guru prays like this as well. I am sorry that I am so bewildered by your illusory energy. I am thinking myself the queen of Vrindavan. I am thinking Nanda Maharaj is my husband. I am thinking that Krishna is my son. I am thinking that all the residents of Vrindavan, they are my subjects. I'm sorry. And then Krishna anyway, he said, oh, enough of this. I want to get back to our rasa, you know. Vatsalya rasa. I want to taste your motherly affection. Even though I am the source of your being, I want to taste our rasa. So he again covered Mother Yashoda. And she again looked at Krishna and said, oh, my beautiful son. She took him on her lap and made him suck her breast. And in this way, Krishna enjoyed this in thinking of himself as the son of Mother Yashoda. And Mother Yashoda enjoyed thinking of Krishna as his son. She was covered over. So the point is that even in the spiritual world, things are subjective. Here we're bewildered by what's called Mahamaya, so we think ourselves, this temporary material body. I, me and mine. We think ourselves the product of this material world, of a certain bloodline, of a certain DNA code, coming in a certain race, in a certain time and place. And we have certain relationships with others, a certain ego, certain sense desires, certain powers, certain weaknesses. This is ego. We identify with this temporary body. But in the spiritual world, in order to facilitate rasa, or loving exchange, between the Lord and his devotees, he also covers them with another energy called yogamaya, by which they understand themselves to be Krishna's devotees. It's interesting, just one last point to finish, I thought this was very interesting, especially for the preachers among us. At Crossways, down on the little shelf by the door, there's these flyers for this festival called Earth Core. And I took the little booklet, and I read the booklet on the way home on the tram one evening. And this festival is something I used to go to before I was a devotee. It's an outdoor festival. I didn't actually go to Earth Core, I went to another one in New Zealand called The Gathering. And it's an outdoor festival. You go to some natural environment. And there they set up all these different ambient zones, you know, with lights and music. And the idea is that the sun will be shining, the techno music will be booming, the reggae, the dub, the trance, the this, the that, the hip hop, will all be in these different outdoor ambient zones with different moods, different flavors. And you'll be there, you'll be happy, you'll be free, you'll be expressing all the colors of your soul, you'll be taking all sorts of drugs to enhance that, and thinking about cosmic things, and you'll be dancing to beautiful music, and it'll be a wonderful soul expression, and it'll be like a village atmosphere, where everybody is friends, and everybody's hearts are flooded and pouring out with love for one another. This is the hippie dream, actually. This was the hippie dream. But the point is, this is actually more attractive than these dance parties in the city. And I was thinking, you know, what it is people are attracted to Vrindavan. Because this is Vrindavan, actually. Vrindavan is not like the other opulent realms of the spiritual world. Vrindavan is set in a natural setting. Very simple. The opulences are peacock feathers, oxides from Govardhan Hill to paint the face, milk products, sparkling crystal clear water, the songs of the parrots, the fruits on the trees. These are the opulences of Vrindavan, the village atmosphere. And there Krishna is dressed as a cowherd boy. Everything is very sweet and playful. Krishna is Dira Lalita. He is serene, but he is also playful. Dira Lalita. He is peaceful, but he is also playful. He's a bit cheeky, actually, Krishna. He is situated there in Vrindavan. And all the devotees, they play games and enjoy loving exchange. And don't worry about very much. About how am I going to pay the bills, how am I going to do this. It's everything simple, sweet. This is like what people want to attain when they go out to these natural settings and dance in the forest. Except they're all hedonists. That's the trouble. They're all hedonists. They're all just tuned into their own desires. They take all these drugs and they hallucinate like anything and they just become bewildered and overwhelmed with their own desires. I was actually reading this book and I was getting a little bit into Maya. I was getting a little bit attracted. Because I was remembering all my pastimes and I was thinking that was quite attractive. But then I thought, why did I become a devotee? You know, I remember being at one of these parties and after one particular experience, I won't go into it too much, but I was sitting there ruminating on cosmic things. And I thought, I want to become a Hare Krishna actually. Because before I'd been going to the Sunday feast in Wellington in New Zealand. I was thinking, that is so sweet there. They chant and they dance. And it's not like this chanting and dancing here. It's spiritual. It's, of course, people there, they think it's spiritual, but it's got a love, a devotion, a flavor to it that you don't find at these events. These events, everybody, you know, it's kind of pretty glamorous and pretty cool, and you feel cool for being there because you can tell your friends, I went to the gathering, or I went to the Earth Core Festival, and I took heaps of drugs, and, you know, it was really great. But that same love is not there, because that love actually arises out of purity, out of a pure heart. It arises out of a completely different conception of the self. You see, basically, out of the myriad of options before the living entity, you can basically divide them into two categories. Number one, the hedonic mentality of the conditioned soul. I am the enjoyer. I am the controller. Therefore, what can I get? I look out, I survey the cosmos with all the other people and all the resources there for the plucking, and they ask themselves, what can I get? How can I control? How can I enjoy? And that manifests in so many varieties of sense gratification and hedonistic culture. And then there's another, the second category is the devotees. And they look at the cosmos, and there's devotees in every tradition actually. They look out and they say, how can I serve? They think of themselves, I am a servant actually, how can I serve? What can I give? This is really the essence of the spiritual transformation. All specifics of different traditions, different manifestations of religion, this is the essential change, shift in consciousness that we could call the spiritual revolution in the living being or the conditioned soul. This vision shift from what can I get to what can I give. So these people dancing, they're thinking, what can I get? How can I enjoy more? What other drug can I take to enhance my high? You know? Maybe somewhere else there's a better dance arena. We should save nature so we can enjoy. You know, they're thinking, we're very spiritual, we care about the environment, we should save it so we can enjoy it. But actually, the same flavor is not there. In order to enter into Krishna Bhakti, to get this highest flavor of existence, this highest juice of spirituality, one must think of oneself as a servant. One must discipline one's mind and senses. One must reduce bodily necessities. One should not be self-serving in Krishna consciousness. One should think, how can I minimize my personal demands? How can I increase my devotional meditation? How can I serve the other devotees? How can I blaze out a more comfortable scene for myself within Krishna consciousness? This is not really the right mentality. Of course we should be comfortable, but we should really be thinking, how can I serve? How can I organize my schedule, my lifestyle, so I can serve more effectively? Basically, the devotees tuning into devotion. Out of all the infinite possibilities in both the spiritual and material spheres, the devotee is tuning into devotion. How can I become a better devotee of Krishna? How can I appreciate Krishna's beauty more? So this is Akrura's consciousness. You see at the end of his prayers, he says, anyway, I'm just bewildered by your illusory energy. I simply offer my respectful obeisances unto you. You can deliver me if you like. He's understood, you know, that Krishna is everything, but then he sees Krishna there in one package on the chariot, the container of everything, yet sitting there. It's inconceivable, actually. The container of everything, yet sitting there in his transcendental skin on the chariot. all contained in one little package, very beautiful. And he says, I simply surrender to your lotus feet. Now you may deliver me if you like, or not. So this is the Bhagavatam is all about the devotees and their relationships with the Lord. We can read this book and get knowledge, we can read this book and get inspiration, and we can learn how to be a devotee from these eternally famous souls. So thank you so much. Any questions or comments on these different points? Thank you so much. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.